This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, the U.S. military wants to expand its detention facilities in Iraq and scientists resurrecting dogs. Joining us on today's roundtable from our New York bureau is John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow in Public Policy, and at our Chicago bureau, Don Turner Trice, reporter and columnist for the Chicago Tribune, along with Hakeem Matabuti, poet and distinguished university professor at Chicago State University. Folks, thanks very much for joining us. I want to get into, before we tackle these issues, a little bit of what we heard from Senator Kennedy. And I noted that I inadvertently said John Dean, perhaps too much thought on deep throat. I meant Howard Dean, talking about African Americans and Democrats for, taking them for granted. But I find it interesting that all the years I grew up, many, many Democrats embraced the word liberal, and save Ted Kennedy and a couple of others, many of them are shunning this. Dawn, what's your thought?
Well, I think that the conservatives have done a very good marketing job in making the word liberal be kind of a dirty word. And it used to be. I mean, it's astounding to me how during the 60s and the times of the civil rights movement, you had a lot of ministers and religious folk out there on the front lines. And so the conservatives have found a way and have done it fairly effectively to take all of that or much of it and use it to their advantage in making liberal a dirty word.
Haki, when you think about Ted Kennedy and, again, that word liberal, so many Democrats oftentimes very proud of it. Do you have to get back to that tag to perhaps reinvigorate the base of Democrats that we've seen perhaps apathy take a hold of?
I think for the most part, Democrats have cowered against the Republicans. That I feel we need to move toward a more independent base. I do feel that black people have been taken for granted by the Democratic Party. And most certainly, as we move to 206, we need to come out in a much more independent third-party force to essentially talk to both Democrats and Republicans. I just don't think we should be taken for granted by anyone or any party.
The most important thing, though, is that the Democratic Party has to make sure that it's not primarily about being not Republican. I think the major problem right now is that there's a kind of identity crisis, and that applies to things even beyond black American issues. There has to be something to build. There has to be some kind of concrete commitment rather than the party being about being angry at people who are considered incorrect. And the Democrats will continue to take advantage of us until we start splitting our vote more. And if we can't split our vote more, then it suggests that there just isn't enough unity in the black community anymore for us to even think of ourselves as a political bloc.
Well, the Democrats have been this anti-party over the last 8 years or so. And I think that we have to really define what we are for.
Exactly.
And move lightning fast to enact those policies that are in the best interest, not only of black people, but progressive people in this country.
That's
Dawn, let me
correct.
Ask you, the DLC oftentimes is forgotten, and that is an organization within the Democratic Party that was brought about, quite frankly, by a number of people, including Bill Clinton, that tried to move the Democratic Party from far left to center. When you think of Clinton, many people see him as liberal. Is this, to some degree, chickens coming home to roost?
Well, excuse me. I think that one of the things that Clinton did effectively was move the party to the middle. And the Democrats really have to, I know that Hakeem mentioned the Democrats standing for something. Well, that's one of the things that they have to not only stand for, but be willing to stand in the face of the onslaught. And I've seen over the years just so much waffling and us not being sure of how to define ourselves.
But also remember that when Clinton shifted to the right, one of the results of that was welfare reform, and it worked. It didn't create a paradise for poor black women, but that was a good thing. And
absolutely.
So I think we just have to be careful what we mean when we talk about Bill Clinton shifting right or giving in to other interests. Sometimes a shift to the right can be good for poor black people.
Absolutely.
Right, but my point in all of that was the question of whether or not those who still hold to the want and the truth of Democrats during particularly the 60s and 70s waving the liberal flag now bury it in the backyard, if you will. So one has to question whether or not for those people, this is that move to the center, if you will, was a good thing, because now, as we see, it seems to be almost a pariah tag for those who wear it.
Well, the Republican attack dog has basically made liberal a bad word. And I think that for the most part, we have to seek a politics that moves toward that which is right, just, and correct for the great majority of people in this country. And so whether one wears a tag liberal or conservative or reformist, or socialist, doesn't matter to me. I think that we have to always look toward what is in the best interest of the great majority of people in this country.
Right, and there's no such thing as being all of one or all of the other. It makes sense to be more in the middle. And welfare reform, as you said, it wasn't perfect, but it was a good thing.
All right. Let's turn our attention to a story that we've been following for quite some time. And yesterday, we saw it close to coming to a head. Two reporters told a federal court judge yesterday that they are prepared to spend 4 months in jail rather than answer questions about their confidentiality sources from the government. And this, of course, is Matt Cooper of the Time Magazine and Judith Miller of the New York Times, and they're seeking to hold on to their confidentiality sources that they utilized in a story that they're concerned about as far as the tried and true confidential source. The interesting point, though, that comes up now is Time Magazine is actually considering giving up this source as a means of, if you want to look at the plus side, the altruistic side, saving their reporter from jail time. Some will suggest they're trying to avoid a heavy fine that would be levied against the magazine, some $270,000, a retroactive fine that could be assessed to Time as well as the New York Times. So I'm curious, Haki, when we look at this and the idea of reporters trying to hold on to confidentiality in terms of the sources, when your magazine or your newspaper steps in, what is your thought here?
I really don't think the fine has anything to do with this. These are multimillion-dollar corporations. I do feel that the First Amendment, for the most part, has not worked well. And since the Fourth Estate, particularly the New York Times and the Washington Post, have failed us. One of the reasons that we're in this war is because they did not do their job. This is why they came out and apologized later on. As far as the Miller and Cooper, I think they need to stand on principle. That, you know, if the First Amendment means anything, if they start revealing sources, then there will be no sources.
One of the most peculiar things about this case is that there's this idea that maybe if Time fesses up, then Miller gets off, and that somehow that Cooper gets off, and that somehow that might also absolve Miller, even if she doesn't fess up, and the Times actually can't do it for her. So it seems like this is less about individuals' actions than some kind of punitive gesture. And then the fact that Novak won't actually say exactly why nobody's bothering him, and all of this based on something that the administration probably did as payback for having been bothered in the first place. It's a very shady business, this one.
It is. And this is a case in which that if both sides gets exactly what it wants, then the public actually loses. It's a case of competing values within our Constitution. On one hand, you have the special prosecutor wanting to gain access to information critical to resolving a crime. And that's the leak, which was a criminal offense. And then on the other hand, you have the public's right to know, and the one way to facilitate this is to protect journalists who have promised confidentiality to their sources. Robert Novak, it was just said, doesn't seem to be in as dire straits as Matthew Cooper or Judith Miller. And the case against Miller is, to me, more absurd, because if she's forced to make the choice of having to testify or go to jail, that would mean that any journalist can be dragged through this, whether or not there was ever even a story. And apparently she didn't publish anything. The Supreme Court has decided not to hear the case. And that's very complicated. What court is going to grant journalists an absolute privilege to keep promises of confidentiality, particularly in cases like these in which the leak itself was a criminal offense.
And we should note that Bob Novak, just for people who may not know, and we throw that name out, a syndicated columnist who also published the name in one of his columns. The interesting point here, and pick up on your thought, but the interesting point here is some people are perhaps less sympathetic to these reporters for this particular story because of the suggestion of what they uncovered, and that is the identity of an undercover CIA operative. And some suggest that that should have never been made public.
But of course,
Robert Novak made it public.
And he's, yeah, what is it? Go ahead.
Robert Novak made it public, and he is somehow as under the radar screen. But as we most of us know, Robert Novak is basically a very conservative columnist, and Cooper and Miller are not necessarily. They write for liberal publications, or at least publications conceived as being liberal.
Yeah, what it's really about is the administration apparently wanting to keep on a certain message and perhaps to punish people who are not with them. And if they were going to be that way, I would be more with them if their actions in Iraq in particular were not bearing such unfortunate fruit. One's beginning to wonder exactly what's being defended.
Right.
All right, let's talk a little bit about that fruit being bared in Iraq. One of the headlines of this week is that the U.S. military is planning to expand its prison system across Iraq to hold more than 16,000 detainees. Some will suggest that this is a, quote, good sign in the sense that it's showing the idea of the insurgency being defeated, quote unquote. Others will say that this is just a sign of expansion and more years on the ground in Iraq. The prison population, we should note, has doubled in more than a year. It was just under 5,500 in June of 2004, and now it tops 10,000.
Well, I think that we first have to understand that Iraq is not a sovereign nation. That if this country was not there holding up the military, that Iraq would be in civil war now as a result of this action of the United States. I think we had to give credit to John Conyers and his hearing around the Downey Street memos. And what people don't really realize is that this move toward Iraq has been a part of the plan for this country and most certainly Britain before the war ever took effect. If I have a minute, I can just share one short sentence from the secret Downing Street memo that was in the New York Review of Books. It stated that the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. The NSC had no patience with the UN route and no enthusiasm for publishing material on the Iraq regime record. There was little discussion in Washington on the aftermath after the military action. So we're in the aftermath now. And policy is being made as we fight, as this country fights.
I was in favor of this war. I am not in favor of the way that it's been conducted. And I knew when this started that this was going to involve putting into lockdown a great many people whose identities are so battered that they don't have anything to do but hate for no reason of their own. Mm-hmm. But what bothers me is that when we see all of these new prisoners, based on Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, mm-hmm. I can't trust that these will not be places where people are tortured and where people are sitting in there who don't belong. So the principle of it, I think this is the nature of what a war has to be. But unfortunately, the way the administration is conducting this war, we can't be happy about what we would otherwise possibly see as constructive and a sign of progress.
Right. I think on one hand, the administration is acknowledging that there is a need for more space to place insurgents. But I think that what's more important is that we wouldn't even be talking about the building of more prisons if there hadn't been so much talk about Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. Part of this is about public relations. The fact that we're even mentioning it is a big deal. And had it not been for the scandals, they would just be building the prisons and there wouldn't be much comment about it.
I think we need to talk about the 14 bases that are being built in Iraq in order for this country to remain there.
And again, I guess that's the question that I raised from the beginning, depending on which side of the fence you sit. John, you suggested that you were in favor of this war. We heard Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld suggests that we could be on the ground for years now in Iraq. Haki mentioned whenever you see bases being built, that is indeed the signal that you are planning to spend upwards of many, many years within that site. As one who was in favor of the war, did you have any idea, did you have any belief that indeed it would become this kind of long-term project?
Well, frankly, yeah, but I thought that what went on long term would be something that showed more and clearer signs of progress. I mean, I knew when we went into this, we're dealing with something that has not been a sovereign nation. We're dealing with some very, very angry people without hope. And I knew that they were going to kick us and kick us to try to get us out. And that was going to require some very tragic, unfortunate things. And so, yes, thousands of people in jail, because if they weren't in jail, they'd be out cutting people's heads off, including Arabic-speaking ones. But, unfortunately, we're in a situation that doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. The insurgents seem to be winning. And that's unfortunate. I wish another administration had done this, in other words.
But if we understand the geopolitics of the nature of this war, if one understands essentially this country would not have went into Iraq if Iraq was just had broccoli rather than oil. All right?
Oh, no, no.
No, 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 of course not. I mean, the Middle East becomes essentially the power base in terms of where this country tries to maintain its hegemony around the
world.
With
about 30 seconds
oil
to
is,
go.
Okay. Oil is very important.
There are people there who want to kill us. Oil is important.
Well, I think we continue to tie the 9/11 thing to Iraq. And
right. Wait till a relative of yours gets blown up in a subway. We have to
We certainly know that that is a completely different argument for a completely different day. And for the time we have left, I better stop it here. John McWhorter, Don Turner Trice, and Haki Matabuti, thanks very much for joining us today. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.